This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much. Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Scott Farquhar to the broadcast. Scott is the co-founder and co-chief executive officer of Atlassian, a collaboration software company that helps teams organize, discuss, and complete shared work. Founded in Sydney in Australia in 2002, Atlassian is well known for its issue tracking application Jira, as well as its team collaboration product Confluence. Scott was awarded the Australian IT Professional of the Year in 2004, and in 2006 was the youngest person ever to be awarded the Australian Entrepreneur of the Year by Ernst & Young, alongside co-founder and co-CEO Mike Cannon-Brookes. Scott holds a Bachelor of Science in Business Information Technology from the University of New South Wales, Australia. I recently caught up with Scott over the phone, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 3, Project and Portfolio Management, as we discussed how Atlassian helps the companies it serves communicate and collaborate on projects, Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we discussed improving productivity of the IT function, and Principle 5, External Partnerships, as we discussed how Atlassian can be a partner with a company beyond involvement with its IT department. We also cover the unusual approach that the company has to sales without a sales force, among a variety of other topics. Scott, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT. Can you begin by sharing a little bit about your background and how Atlassian got started?
Mike and I started kind of out of college. We didn't really want to get a real job, have to wear a suit. And there was no real tech industry in Australia when we started in 2001. Was less technology sort of after the dot-com crash worldwide, but there was really nothing in Australia. And the alternatives would go work for Accenture or IBM or some sort of insurance company. So we thought that would be pretty boring. And instead, we started what's probably Australia's most successful software company today. And originally, you know, we didn't know what we wanted to do, but we really had some thoughts that the way, you know, software would get bought and sold would change drastically over, you know, over the coming years. And so instead of building something that, you know, gets sold through enterprise salespeople, we took the more approach of, you know, put it online, sell it, you know, through a an online portal, app able to try it, download and install it. And, the problem we originally solved was around IT ticketing and bug tracking. And that evolved to be all manner of workflow applications from, you know, sort of tracking features and requests and all the way through to what we do now, which is tracking customer service and help desk tickets as well. And a couple of things, if I think through, one is that we believe that software would overall, you know, sort of eat the world, I guess, is to take the Marc Andreessen terms. So we believe that, if software would eventually take over the world. And so we provided all the tools are necessary for software teams to be successful. And over time, that mission has evolved to actually helping every team to be successful. And Atlassian provides all the products that you need for a modern information worker to be successful. We have workflow tools. We have content tools for people to create and consume content. And we have communication tools like HipChat that allow, you know, teams of people to work. And today, it's no longer the sort of lone genius that makes a difference. It's actually teams of people getting together, often with disparate backgrounds, to build something. And our unique magic is helping those teams be successful. So that's kind of where we've come from and the thing that we do and our mission today is to unlock the potential in every team.
Given that mandate, who then is your typical entry point, and does it differ greatly depending upon the company that you're working with? Is it CIOs in some cases, CMOs in others, or does it tend to be one executive over another?
The people that bring us in have historically, when we started, been the software team lead, or someone that was bringing in a tool for their own team. And I guess they get to our second part of the business model, which is that we land and expand inside an organization. Because if you look at the way that software used to be sold, and you know this from your experience with CIOs, is that, people would used to sell software products to the CIO, which is a really difficult thing to do because there's only one of them, and they're too busy out on the golf course, playing golf with one of your competitors. And so really difficult place to get in. And that's because software, really, when you built software, it was for the entire company. You'd do an SAP deployment or a HRIS deployment or a Oracle kind of a forms deployment across your entire organization. So you had to enter through that. The CIO was the gatekeeper. What we found is that we have taken a different approach and believe that we can land with any team inside the organization, because the problem we solve is how that team works together more effectively. And the great part about it is, as we're more successful, we expand throughout the organization. So Sotheby's, started with us in, just their IT department, and now Sotheby's use us across their entire workflow in terms of, well outside of IT. They actually use it for facilities and organizing to move art on and off the auction floor across their entire, art collection across, their London offices. And, so by taking a team-based approach of what we sell, we can land almost anywhere inside an organization. Now, typically, we still start with the more technical people because they're the people that today go out and search for software. But we see increasingly less technical as we solve more and more workflow applications for other people. We end up with less and less technical people bringing us in.
Very interesting. You mentioned at the outset, Scott, that your organization's taken a rather different approach to sales from some of your fellow technology companies. I mean, companies like Box spend roughly 80% of revenue on sales, Salesforce nearly half, whereas, you spend next to nothing, as you pointed out. And I'm curious, what the insight was there in terms of taking that approach. How did it occur to you to grow that way without the more traditional Salesforce?
Two reasons. One is that, geography in Australia forced us to think differently about how we approached it at the start. And then the second part is that we have the discipline to always look at, whenever we had people involved in the process, how do we automate that? So we're not anti-salespeople, we're pro-automation. And, so we experiment with people doing things. Hey, let's see if we call customers, every customer that downloads, what happens? And then we go, okay, well, some of them liked it, some of them didn't. Well, maybe we could automate that. What do they like? What do they not like? And that automation flows back, and it means that, if someone in Venezuela downloads the software at 4 a.m, US time, they can get the same amazing experience than someone who downloads in Palo Alto. And if you think about the way the world's going, you go to the Apple store these days, you can walk into the Apple store and talk to someone, or you can order it online in your underwear at 3 a.m, and you get the same great experience in both places. They don't force you to have to talk to a person. And it's the strength of the products that make the difference. And I think that's the way the world is going. More and more, the people talk about the consumerization of IT. It's not only the expectations for ease of use that go up, it's the entire consumption experience that people want changed.
You and your co-founder, co-CEO, Mike Cannon-Brookes, founded the company 14 years ago, and I was interested to note that you did not seek VC funding initially, at least, that you self-funded the entity essentially. And I'm curious, as you think about those early years before you sought VC capital, how the path was different as a result of your having done so.
I think we had two advantages, at least two advantages, in not taking venture capital. One is the timeline. That VCs, their model is that they make almost all their returns on one, or two companies out of their fund. And so the way their pattern recognition is all about, okay, how do I push all the companies to breaking point, and one or two of them will, survive. And they need those one or two to grow, triple digits for 5 years to make the returns. And that means you can't do things and have patience like not having a sales force and experimentation and finding the right way of going to market. Often it leads you to doing the first, you know, method of going to market or, you know, adopting sort of unhealthy practices or stealing from the future because you have to chase that growth rate. So that's one thing. And the second is that VCs, you know, have great pattern recognition of things that they've seen before and things that have been successful before. So if you want to build a truly different company that thinks about things very differently, the pressure of VC is going to be cutting against that entrepreneurial spirit and grain that, you know, that you want to do. And all the VCs, they've only ever seen software companies that have heavy sales forces. And so, you know, we're sort of heretical to them. And yeah, so I think, you know, the timeline that we had to get our business and our business model right and the ability to think different about it were both aided by not taking VC for the first, I think, 8 years of our business.
And I'm curious also, we've alluded to the fact that you not only have a co-founder, but a co-CEO. How does that work practically? How do you and Mike divide up responsibilities? Curious to understand how that relationship has evolved.
Yeah, I think the advantage is that we've just grown up in the business together. And, you know, many companies are lucky to have their, you know, founder around. And I think more and more, you know, tech companies realize the importance of, you know, founder-led companies. And even working in those companies is, you know, even if the founder's not the CEO, there's a certain advantage of having that founder around that has the institutional DNA and what's happened since the beginning. And we're lucky enough to have two of those, which I think allows us to have more bandwidth to do different things inside the business. And I think we have overlapping skill sets, but we have slightly different perspectives on things, and that gives us an advantage to, you know, and if I think through the other examples, you know, Google had two founders and two CEOs before Eric Schmidt, HP, Microsoft, Apple, you know, like there's a lot of places where, you know, we have two founders. And if you think about our mission about teams, you know, we start at the top. We've been a team since the beginning. And that, I guess that affects the way we build stuff and how we build for our customers.
I'm curious just for your thoughts on the entrepreneurial community within Australia. There are some great similarities between our countries. I'd be curious with your thoughts across your 14 years of experience, how supportive the country, the government regulations or lack thereof are to entrepreneurs like Mike and yourself.
When we started 15 years ago, there was no one to point to. There was no technology industry. There was no examples of success and even very few examples of failure. So it just didn't exist. And over the 15 years of time, we've come a long way. And, you know, we were proud of Silicon Beach in Sydney. And we sort of we just started a Tech Sydney group to, you know, to represent the startups and the technology industry in Australia. And because governments are a little bit slow to perhaps get behind the newer industries. That said, I think Silicon Valley is a unique place in the world because it just has, you know, it's sort of the mecca for technology and, you know, everyone wants to copy it, you know, whether it's Australia or Israel or, you know, other, you know, Berlin, everyone wants to be like Silicon Valley. And I think Australia has a great chance. The way we look at it, I guess, is that we have a foot in both camps. We end up having the advantage of, you know, leaning into the deep technical, you know, history of Silicon Valley and, you know, pulling in people from, you know, tech giants like Apple and Facebook and Google that come work for us, but also having a foot in Australia where, you know, being out of the Valley mindset allows us to think differently and also, you know, being a very big fish in a small pond allows us to get the best talent. I think we had over 50% of the computer science graduates in Australia applied for a job with Atlassian. And, you know, so that just allows us to have the best and the brightest in Australia work for us.
Last December, you went public on the NASDAQ, and I'm curious why you elected to go public as well as how things have changed now that you have done so.
Yeah, when we think about Atlassian, we've been, you know, we've got a very long-term view on the company. Not having VCs sort of, you know, getting in for an exit, you know, from the very start, we've had to think about why do we do this? And our mission really is to unleash the potential in every team And we're just getting started at that. We started with software teams. Now we do incredible things for IT teams. We're just scratching the surface of legal, marketing, HR across an organization. And so, in the same way you think about Microsoft had the vision for a, computer on your desk and home, our vision is that, every knowledge worker uses an ICM product every day to make their teams more productive. And we have, we're just getting started. We have 50, between 50 and 60,000 companies around the world that pay us on a monthly basis to use our products. So we've had a very long-term view, and being public is just one milestone along that journey. Allows us to tap into the capital markets and build out a board and a whole bunch of other things. Just sort of allows us to, achieve our goals long-term.
And I noticed you actually have a penetration rate of the Fortune 100 of 85% or perhaps even in excess of that. And I'm curious how you're thinking about, continuing to foster broader relationships with companies like those and their equivalents around the world. What are some of your strategic priorities related to that for the foreseeable future?
I mean, the way I think about it is when it makes you can help inside an organization. Let's just take, firstly, is helping more teams. We start often inside one or two teams inside an organization, and there's a very few number of our customers that actually use us for every, even just software team across the company. So one area is expanding the teams we serve. Another one is expanding the types of things we solve for them. And so an example is we brought to market about 2 years ago a Jira service desk, and that was completely driven by customer demand who, were using our products, to support their, IT teams inside internally. And we recognize that need and build out a full-fledged IT service desk product for them. So expanding out the number of teams inside an organization is another way we expand. Third is that we have a marketplace that third parties build upon to build plugins and add-ons that solve often functionality that is more niche than we need to solve problems that apply to all teams, but they might have smaller problems. And an example is software testing or enterprise areas. We have third parties build things. I guess they're the three areas of expansion inside organizations. It's still even if we sold not to another company ever again, we would still do really well just inside our existing customers.
You mentioned earlier that you serve a great number of functions within traditional businesses. And an advantage in focusing on a single function is that you can get to know that functional office more deeply and cater to the evolving needs of that one area. And I'm curious, how do you remain abreast of the evolving needs of so many different functions within the enterprise?
It's a good question. So for us, if you think about it, the core problem that we solve is helping teams to collaborate with each other. And that's a pretty fundamental problem that we solve. And so that's sort of the base of where we start. And the products we have, if you look at them, almost all knowledge workers, whether they're lawyers or they're accountants or they're the marketing team or software developers, do three things each day. They have their list of things they need to get done, and work moves around the organization. And we have our Jira and Jira Service Desk and workflow applications that serve them. The second one is that most knowledge workers create and consume content. And we have a set of products in Confluence and associated other ones around creating content and collaborating. And third is that communicating. And so we have a basic kind of the products that we have to serving customers. And then, we listen to those customers really well. We get, I think it's in the tens of thousands. I haven't got the exact number ahead of me, but tens of thousands of items of feedback a week from our customers. Both through support requests, through interactions, on the phone, but more importantly, net promoter scores and surveys that we do with our customers. And that's a huge competitive advantage for us, is how well we can listen to our customers. And really started with our heritage, where we had a public bug tracker for, years, and it's still very uncommon to do that. So we've always had a dialogue with our customers. And, as I've mentioned, the Jira Service Desk example where our customers were asking for it because of our feedback mechanisms, we can identify that need perhaps other companies wouldn't have identified it. And, you know, business model, again, isn't about schmoozing the heads of a function on a golf course. It's about providing a product that they need each day and getting a foothold somewhere inside the organization. And once you are successful there, spreading throughout the organization. So it's a little bit different to the, you know, top-down selling that of years past.
You know, as we talked about a little bit earlier, one of the advantages of having such a low sales budget is that a lot more of revenue can be plowed back into R&D. What are some of the areas that you're putting that those R&D funds towards these days?
And the ones that are, you know, most obvious, as you'd expect, you know, cloud and mobile are big for us. You know, the different markets that we have, you know, IT obviously is a huge market for us, and our service desk product is still early in that space, so there's large investments there. And then there's always, you know, products and other things that I can't talk about that are in development.
Scott, this has been a really great conversation. Are there other aspects where you would wish to speak about that I happen not to cover? Anything that you think is particularly noteworthy that you'd like to note that hasn't naturally come out of the conversation?
Yes, I'm sure there's lots of things, but the things that come to mind, if I think about, you know, what you've talked about, you know, culture of innovation is something we're really passionate about. And, you know, we've got some, it's weird, you know, years ago, I used to think innovation was something that just happened out of thin air. And now I'm sort of taking a different viewpoint that, well, actually there's different models of innovation that, you know, starts off as the founder is the innovative one. And then, you know, one day you might cluster people in a lab for innovation. And I think the ultimate zenith is where every person in the organization gets to participate in the innovation machine. And there's a couple of things we do that I think support that. One is that a culture of openness is really important because, you know, if your employees get put in tiny little boxes and they only see their part of the world, they don't see the problems that your customers have or the problems that are happening internally. And so openness and transparency is really important in order for your employees to know where to innovate. And the second one they have to do is they actually have to space and permission to innovate. And we have innovation programs like Ship It, which we run once a quarter and is actually running next week, where our employees get 24 hours of their own time to build something that sort of scratches their own itch. And, you know, these 24-hour sort of hacking sessions end with a presenting to your peers. And we actually, these days, I think we have semifinals, quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals now in Sydney because we have close to 1,000 people participate. Actually, we have over 1,000 people worldwide that participate in the Ship It event. And, you know, an example was our service desk offering actually came out of an employee's Ship It project. And we have many examples like that where that innovation happens. And, you know, maybe for readers of your column or maybe still in the same model that I was a while ago, which is innovation should just happen. But I believe you kind of need to give them the permission to innovate, the opportunity to do it, and then enough information and context to know what's valued in innovation for the company and for our customers.
That's great. Yeah, what a great example as a means of fostering that innovation and ensuring that it's something that such a large percentage of the organization is not only thinking about, but truly getting involved in.
Well, Scott Farquhar, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT and sharing a bit of your perspectives and the history of your company, Atlassian. It's been a great conversation.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call Meta Strategies Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to Meta Strategies' five principles of World Class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks,
the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Armin. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.